Ladies and gentlemen, the second talk this afternoon is from Steve Higginson, who I wasn't expecting to have to do an introduction, so he's from Liverpool, and he's not going home, because we're keeping him, and that's it. Away you go, Steve.
Thanks, Rich. Really delighted that to speak at this session because, as is my wont, I want to add a dissenting voice to what I believe is this grand narrative of enclosure and what it means. To give you a background to where we're coming from, and the work that's... We developed a critique of Liverpool being the capital of culture this year, European capital of culture. And we developed a critique of that. Our book's coming out in June called Liverpool Culture of Capital. Because for the last 18 months, since Liverpool has been given this status, the whole city is becoming enclosed by huge forms of mobile capital. And particularly what's being enclosed is the beauty of Liverpool's waterfront, which in the 1880s was described as Liverpool is the New York of Europe, a world city rather than merely a British provincial city. And that waterfront has now been basically destroyed. In the book we define it as the quarterfront, because a quarter is basically the only access we have to that beautiful river. Up to 3 years ago, you could do a 10-mile walk from the north end of Liverpool to the south and back round. In fact, the actual shape of that walk is similar to an old ocean-going liner. It's the old dock, the edge of the dockside has taken on, even in the absence of shipping, it still has that shape to it, which has now been totally destroyed by what we call the rise of a quangocracy. This level of government agencies, the city council, all other Merseyside Development Corporation, where there is no dividing line. One just fuses into the other, so there is no accountability. But when we were developing this critique, an appalling murder took place on the outskirts of Liverpool to a young boy called Rhys Jones, who was gunned down in an area of Liverpool, Croxteth, Norris Green, 11 years of age, and happened to be walking home from a game of football and was caught in a crossfire of a row over drugs. The lad who unintentionally shot him was 15 years of age. And what we started looking at then is these estates on the outskirts of Liverpool that from the 1950s onwards there was a wholesale shift of people from the edge of the river, because these people are all what we call river people. That's where they lived. north and south, and they were shifted further and further back into the countryside. England's green and pleasant land, as it were. Only one way in and one way out. And these places now, and it's both sides of Liverpool, they really are places that time has forgotten. So what we started looking at, and what we wanted to look at, what we define as this movement of people from the edge of the river to the countryside. We became reconnected to a fellow called Ken Walpole, who did a series of history workshop journals on English. He was part of the group that produced English Nationalism, Ralph Samuel. So we're working with Ken to look at what we call the English arrangements of place and space. And in particular, this whole idea of what we call partition and prejudice. Now, in terms of defining what we need to define today, enclosure. And talking about enclosure, I couldn't think of a better place to speak about it than in a bridewell. Because the bridewell was the epitome of enclosure. The enclosure of people. And when all the history that I've been absorbing the last couple of years, what has always troubled me from an English radical historian perspective is that we seem to know more about sheep, cattle, acreage, more about that than we do about people. So my definition of enclosure, I take from the work of Michel Foucault, French philosopher and writer, and he described enclosure as the principle of enclosure requires a partitioning of time, space, and movement. Enclosure seeks to eliminate all transient pluralities. And that came from his great work, Discipline and Punish. So we're trying to tie up what Foucault says with an alternate history of enclosure, which is a history of the English state. Now, I would argue that part of the problem has been dealing with this issue is that we have allowed history to become partitioned. So history, we have allowed historians to divide history into particular epochs and periods. And what that has tended to ignore is the continuing presence of the English state, which is the oldest state in the world. Now, the very nature of the word state comes from the word Latin status, which means static. So any nation state requires a degree of stasis and settlement. And what I put forward yesterday is that's why nation states always have difficulty with port cities that are transient. People are always on the move, coming and going. And that's a fundamental reason that port cities have globally create difficulty for their own nation state. So what I want to do, and we call it, we're going to try and stake out the posts to give an alternate view of enclosure, an alternate view of the English nation state. There was a discussion before about St. George, who is the patron saint of England. George comes from Georgian, Gorgion, he who will till the soil. And I would suggest that the patron saint of England gave England the opportunity to then spread its empire globally, and within that empire, a deliberate partitioning and enclosure of the colonized countries were all deemed and shaped by agriculture. Now, I'd like to start with what I would suggest is the first enclosure that took place with England. And that is the colonisation of Ireland that began in 1172. Again, our history will tell us that England's problems with Ireland start in the 16th and the 17th century. My own history of Liverpool tells me that Liverpool is given its royal charter because it is a beachhead for the colonisation of Ireland, and a continuing beachhead whereby over two centuries the English state, whenever it needed to settle the rebellious settlements of Ireland, would deliver a military muster to Liverpool. And under that Liverpool's charter, Liverpool was expected to supply X amount of people to at the King's behest under the threat of death. So I think that's another reason why Liverpool has always had a difficult relationship with authority, especially state authority, because that is embedded in our own history. But staking out the posts, Ireland is colonised in 1172, and then we come to what I will argue is the first apartheid state in the world, and that is the apartheid of Ireland under the Statutes of Kilkenny from 1366 to 1367, where an area was built that later became the Pale. That was what it was called, from the Latin palus, a state, where Englishness had to, the English language, English customs, had to take place within the Pale. What mustn't happen is any mix between the English and the Irish, through marriage, through language, through religion, and all other aspects of everyday life. And what's interesting when you read the charter of the Statutes of Kilkenny is how identical the language is to the Jim Crow laws that came later in America, and what the apartheid laws of South Africa came to mean. The language is identical. So, why would that be? Our own history that we've looked at, and I come from a family in Liverpool, a father who was a classical artisan, voted Labour, yet would not allow a black person or an Irish Catholic into the house. So my whole upbringing was one of apartheid. But just not mine. Fact of life in Liverpool, that up to 1960, we're still voting in Protestant councils. The Protestant working class of Liverpool was electing Protestant councils. Now, the journey that I took, because when I started reading all the, you know, radical history from the various historians, this celebration of what Perry Anderson in the New Left Review in the 1960s called Protestant hegemony. What had it achieved? And Perry Anderson was using those words in particular to challenge Edward Thompson, Christopher Hill, Rodney Hilton, Eric Hobsbawm, people from this English radical tradition. And I think there's a what Perry Anderson was posing has never really been answered. This crossover between Protestantism, nationalism, where is the radicalism? But it just wasn't Perry Anderson. Ralph Samuel on History Workshop Journal in 1980 also made the point. This ambiguity of free-born Englishmen that was bordering on nationalism, xenophobia. But of course Samuel's work was like body swerved, if you like. And I think these are very, very important questions, because the British left has never done empire. You know, you cannot find up to 1925, whether it was the TUC, whether it was the Labour Party or the Communist Party, none of them opposed the British Empire. They opposed that it wasn't socialist or communist, but they didn't oppose it per se as an imperial, you know, imperial power and colonisation. So I would like to return to this Protestant hegemony and try and put what went on from 1400 to, or a continuation of it, within a religious context. Because that is the only way I can see we can do it. And to prove this in a way, I spent a month in South Africa a few months ago. Because South Africa was the place that I should go to follow my family tradition. Presbyterian, Calvin and Luther. I will find the end result in South Africa. And when I went there, I spent a month in the Transvaal, attending every day the Lutheran and Calvinist churches. And there's a huge movement out of South Africa now. There is another great trek, another exodus of Afrikaner who will not, under any circumstances, integrate with the indigenous population. And their reasons are quite simple. They guided me to Genesis 1:4, that clearly states, God is the great separator, land from sea, man from woman, lightness and dark, black and white. And that's what they hold dear to. That Genesis 1:4, that is their, well it is, it's literally their Bible. Now, I don't think we can wish this away under capitalism or false consciousness, or this is deeply, deeply religious. And it should be dealt with that way. Because if we can deal with it that way, we can also start to write in what I would consider to be some new history Peter spoke about the Chicago Martyrs. We've got schools in the north end of Liverpool called the English Martyrs. They are Catholic women who were burned to death from 1640 onwards. And they were burned to death because they were called the Liverpool Recusants. Recusare, from the Latin, to refuse. And what they refused was to give up their religion. Because the English state, politics and religion were tied together in a single knot of anti-Catholic prejudice. So the English martyrs, the women, are remembered in these schools along the whole dockside of the north end of Liverpool. That history, I can't find it anywhere at all in history book. And the reason why, I would suggest, is that what Perry Anderson said was quite right in New Left Review. That there is a strand of English radicalism which is very, very problematic because it's got religion at its core. That somehow the Protestants and the English Reformation and then the English War was somehow progressive. I would suggest that it was very regressive because it's within that period, that Republican period, that the biggest period of enclosures goes on. That 20-year period from 1640 to 1660. Peter also mentioned this question of colour. And it's a study that we're doing now of the Puritan policy on colour. And when I mean that, I mean colour was abolished in the year 1400. Thousands of dyers and woad makers and bleachers were thrown out of work all over Europe. Because the word colour comes from the Latin celare, to conceal. So colour was a diabolical act, the work of the devil. And I'm using this terminology because we tend to forget that what the, and I hate to use the word, the Black Plague. I'm speaking in here in Bristol today, and I don't know whether people are aware, but the blame for the Black Plague was blamed on the city of Bristol. That it was the gateway, and that is why St. George's Channel became St. George's Channel, because St. George was the guardian of Englishness against everything that was coming up that channel from Europe. So that Black Plague, why was it called black? Why do we have the Black Death? What is it with the Puritans in this conception of colour? Well, we're back to Genesis again, you see. The light and the dark. Dark is diabolical, the devil, and blackness is impure. The sign of eternal. That I would suggest is where you can follow from Jim Crow laws to apartheid South Africa. It is that level of impurity, and what is deemed to be impure is still there today. What then transpires, and Peter makes a point in the Many-Headed Hydra, Peter, where you talk about the Blackie Moore and the development of Protestant and Greek philology. What was the link between the Protestant religion and ancient Greece? And the study that is going on the secular side is linked to Aristotle and Pythagoras and their themes of limits, boundaries, and what is called cessante moviente, the cessation of movement. So when Isaac Newton's throwing the ball up in the air, he's not doing it to test the laws of gravity. He's doing it to test what is high, what is low, what goes up must come down. And he's looking at the structure of society in that. Basic structure of who's on top, who's at the bottom, what will fall, what will stay, what will rise. All that type of thing is going on. So Francis Bacon, the deviser of plantation slavery, another great enclosure, is a great studier of Aristotle and Aristotle's ideas of limits and boundaries, and human matter must have bounds, must have limits. So Bacon takes that on board to produce the idea of the plantation. The other, in the most interesting aspect when I was in South Africa, going into the old tribal regions, that the indigenous population of South Africa, enclosure does not mean to them land grab. Enclosure means to them restriction of movement. Because for the British colonial power to exist, it had to have people working the land. So their idea of agrarian work, as it were, fills them with horror, because they will equate that automatically to slavery and to this restriction of movement. So when I looked at the Transkei Pass laws, where they were allowed to leave the settlement with permission, a whole series of restrictions on them, restricting their movement, I then realised that they were no different to the pass laws that were developed at Kilkenny in 1362, and then developed outside of London in 1630, and then outside of Liverpool in 1645, where the Catholic poor were moved and settled, and could only move off their settlement with particular instructions from Justice of the Peace, who were then automatically linked to the English state. But I just want to end on this point, really, that when I went back and reread your book, Peter, The London Hang, what struck me was this, the defiling of the human body, the taking apart of the human body. And I don't know whether that forms part of what I'm trying to discuss today, the partitioning of the human body by the actual body politic, which is state power. And the only thing I could end on, really, is that if we are really concerned and want to abolish enclosures forever, then we have to, I would suggest, abolish the nation state. Free borders, free lines, free association, and free everything. That, to me, is the only thing we can do. Because if we don't, what I find interesting through this whole study that we've done, that it's state power that is involved continually with, even when the first enclosures occurred, around about 1100, 1200, the word enclosure was originally deemed to be a letter of state. It was an official letter written to agree to a form of partitioning of place and space. So yeah, I think that's what we've got to do. It's no big deal, that is it? Do that tomorrow. All right, thanks.
And
then how can we break down those enclosures and those borders? How can we get rid of borders and those things? Is there any, I mean, obviously there's not going to be a simple answer or a simple strategy, but are there actually practical ways that can be done in our society today? The only
people
who I see who have that on their agenda, and I'm sorry to be biased here, are the various anarchist groups, open borders and that. And that's, someone took me to shop, Kabili shop is it, in Bristol, had a morning there which re-energised and gave me hope that there is still this anarchist space there. And I think it's a very important point you raise, because I'd just like to, this is an essay written by Pierre Proudhon, and it's called To Be Governed, and he wrote this in 1860. To be governed is to be watched, inspected, spied upon, directed, law-driven, numbered, regulated, enrolled, indoctrinated, preached at, controlled, checked, estimated, valued, censored, commanded, registered, counted, taxed, stamped, measured, numbered, assessed, punished, and enclosed. And I think that is just as important today as when he wrote it. But I think we need to have, and I have great difficulty, because it's this whole debate around the nation state. A lot of my ex-comrades, and they are, who come from a different tradition from me, they come from a traditional Marxist position where they don't really deal with the state or the nation state, and that's what I find difficult, and that's why we've had a bit of a parting of the ways, as it were, because ultimately all the research that we've done just keeps bringing us back to the great enclosure of them all, which is the nation state. Now how we do that, I just think it's these wonderful pockets of anarchism still keep pushing it out there.
On your very last sentence, which of course has got a fundamental truth in it, although somehow, on one hand, I see as fundamental truth, on the other hand, is can be quite problematic, and it kind of pushes us in front of the abyss and kind of an impasse. You know, if you want to abolish enclosures, you must abolish the nation state. The problem with that way to put it, with that I would have, is that it looks like there is a sequence here, that in order to abolish enclosures and establish commons, this way, then we have to get rid of the nation state, which is a logic which, I mean, to be honest, in translating in slightly different languages, if I go to a meeting or a discussion with of many groups in the left, Trotskyist groups or whatever, depends on, that would be, there is a linearity there. Okay, if we have to get rid of this in order to have revolution, if we can, we need to have a revolution in order to establish, you know, whatever it is that we want to establish. In the old days, the same logic applied to keep particular struggles of commoners, women, black, etc. We will deal with your problems after the revolution. I feel it opens up a dangerous frame of
you know, thinking. Well, in fact, if I'm thinking about, you know, the example you're talking about, the, you know, the people working on migrant issue and opening borders, etc., which is in fact one way to struggle through commons, because when you cracking up borders and struggling with migrants, you are in fact commoning in one sense, and that very commoning is or might, depending on the power relation, in fact put the nation state as it is in some danger, you know. So it's the other way around. It's not like in order to have commons we have to abolish the nation states, but actually it's through commoning that we subvert the nation state, or we might have any chance of subverting the nation states and abolishing it in the end. It's a different way of, I think, of prioritizing really what it is. That's just, you know, just top of my head.
It's no coincidence that the developments and the huge debate that goes on about immigration and migration in Britain on Thursday night, the BNP, boom. You see, I would accept your point if we were all this, because the biggest block, I would say, in what you're saying is white skilled working class people who will constantly and still today throw up the arguments they are taking our jobs. Now, that is a given that has been endemic in this country since probably the English nation was founded. That is a common, because skill of itself is exclusionary, it's not inclusive, it's male, patriarchal, and that's the problem that I have with these continuing debates that we have, when in fact the reality tells us totally, totally different. What I try to give a view of is that enclosure is tied in to the biggest enclosure of all, the nation state. Now, there can be a sequence, but ultimately you will come up against, at the end of that sequence, the power of the state.
Well, one thing on whether in Bolivia they still respect May Day and the Chicago Martyrs. I wasn't here this morning, but it seemed to me that their demand of an 8-hour work and recreation and rest was a very valid demand. It's not relevant to what you're saying. But also I'm responding to the woman at the back who said something about, is there a way forward? And I really find it's a bit sort of sad just to put to the anarchists. This morning I was playing football in support of the Bolivian government, democratically a progressive government which has nationalised various of its energies and which has enabled it to provide sort of food and pensions and few benefits which are pretty important, I think, for survival. And so I think, okay, the anarchists, that's fine, whatever they do. But I think to know, you know, we are deprived of what's going on in the world. In today's Guardian, there is a very vicious piece against Bolivia. What we won't learn is that the rich parts of Bolivia are trying to withdraw and then bring down the whole country. You know, so I think, you know, we can get depressed because we're not given the information of what's happening.
Well, you had your hand up, but we must have had his hand up.
Oh, I did.
Yeah, you did.
Okay. In that case, what's interesting when you're talking about the state and how the state, you know, represents itself, is in a certain way in a position of stasis, categories and sort of etymology of state. First thing I thought of, oh yes, but the etymology of stasis comes from the Greek word for civil war. And then, you know, you're mentioning Proudhon, one of the other most famous quotes other than property is theft. A lot of people attribute the circle A symbol to a Proudhon quote that says, anarchy is order, government is civil war. I was thinking of that, and so there's this interesting paradox in the state of the fact that, you know, sort of imposes itself as a system of stasis and order, but in fact it can only do that by actually creating constant conflict. Governments are basically construct themselves as a, you know, as a permanent war, at least on some aspect of their own population. I was going to ask how you think that fits in, you know, with the sort of the Protestantism element, and how that, because I'm curious how those two elements come together. But then the comment on Bolivia made me think that Bolivia is a really interesting test case about the political possibilities of a state, because, you know, they almost have a kind of dual power phenomena going on in Bolivia right now. It's not, I mean, Evo Morales, like a few years ago, was a convener of PGA, which is a largely, you know, anarchistic-inspired global network. Now, obviously, he's head of state. These head of state sort of put there in power by groups like groups in El Alto and other groups, which are really kind of reject the principle of state and are kind of putting up with him as much as they have to, as a way of like allowing them to be largely autonomous and self-governing. So I'm wondering, you know, do you think that there's some, what would be an intermediary model that, I mean, as an anarchist, I keep wondering about this. You know, is it possible to create some sort of intermediary dual power, potentially dual power strategy like that? Or what would be the alternative to it when it comes to actually creating viable long-term strategies?
Need the government be a civil war?
Well, the duality, dual power aspect, I've always found very, very, very interesting. What concerns me is the fact that the English nation state and its institutions are incredibly vast and huge. From about 10 of the 11th century, Britain developed this apparatus and institutions, and it seems that it's permanently with us. It's always with us. Whether you elect members of Parliament to Parliament, and then when you get into Parliament to see the state apparatus that they're tied into, this separate world of English governance, statehood, that they are governed by. I'm always reminded of Alexander de Tocqueville. He wrote this piece about the desperation of politicians to be elected and to live on public money. And when we analyse what the House of Parliament represents, and this separate world of statehood, and the fact that, just as an example, one condition that I would say would be a start, but you can't even get a consensus around it, is the 1701 Act of Settlement, what I call the Dangerous Catholics Act, where Catholics aren't allowed to see to particular areas of power within the English nation state. Now, the fact that that's been on the statute books since 1701, and no one has even, that in its, you know, very few people have gone near it in terms of having it. What is the point of it? Why is it there? Because that is a constant reminder to the anti-Catholic prejudice of the English state.
At the back.
I've got a couple of points really. My first being that's this whole, I spoke about encoders and the fact. It's so easy to say to a bunch of people, however, basically, the whole thing of enclosures, I think, really starts from real deep-rooted sense of ownership and privatisation and capitalism, where everyone from all different levels wants to own a bit of property, wants to own a bit of land, wants to build a house, and that's all over the world. So that kind of mentality that people go work towards really, is ownership. And that's something to overcome, but then that's so ingrained in people. And then, the thing is with what you're saying about, because I think it's absolute bollocks that it's anarchists who just think, oh, we have to destabilise the power or whatever, because most people I know who were fucking not even not as his men, and they all want that same thing as well. And I think it's really disempowering to say that it's only that's what anarchists want, because then it makes it defined and it makes it separate. And I think there's so many people who really want that. Like, it doesn't matter where they're coming from, it doesn't matter what colour they are or anything. I've got so many people from all walks of life who are all thinking that same thing, but they've not necessarily got the kind of power to vocalise it, or they haven't necessarily got the kind of articulation to kind of define it or whatever, but that is what their common kind of grounding is in. So I think, that's my first point, is about that. And then my second point is about the fact of unworking. I think there is practical things that we can do in terms of, deconstructing enclosures all around the world, because the thing is, there is enclosures, actual literal enclosures. There's mental ones, and then there's literal ones all over the world, ones which are defined by labour, ones which are defined by power, ones which are defined by the legacy of racism. So there's all these enclosures defined by different things. In Britain, we've got lots of enclosures defined by privatisation and all that kind of bollocks. So there's all this going on, and I think
we have to unite. The state divides us. That's what it does, because it keeps people down. By dividing people and saying that there's only a certain sector of society that's going to change anything, then we're divided and we're not united and we're not powerful. But everybody knows that the people have got the most power, mass has the most power, and so the only way we could overcome the state is to unite, and it not being about breaking down.
And not being about politics, forget politics. I really think about forget politics. It doesn't have to be a political stance in a way. I know this might be really radical here, because you're probably all really into politics, but most people I know, people, working classes or whatever, most people I know from all over bloody country and whatever, are politics wouldn't necessarily come into it, but it's just a general grounding belief that they're getting fucked over. They know they're getting fucked over, they know what their rights should be. That little point that you made about politicians want to live off public money. There's a lot of people in this country want to live off public money. You sign on and all that, and I've been signing on for years. And I don't know, I think it has to come from people and a belief in their rights and what they're entitled to. And it has to come from people, it doesn't come from any political stance, I think.
My apology. The romantic idea that I would like to get to is the abolition of the nation state. However, within that, there are, and you're looking what's going on in Bristol. You're in a different position where we were in Liverpool, where there is a groundswell of opposition now in terms of gentrification of particular areas of Bristol. Now, there's a...
I'm from Bradford, and I'm fucking everyone. I'm from Bradford, where the whole place has been knocked down, still fucking shopping centre. And it got knocked down 5 years ago, and everyone you speak to is pissed off at the council. Everyone's pissed off at the government. Everyone's pissed off at fucking privatisation. But we don't let them know that it's called privatisation, but everyone's fucking pissed off. And it's I really think, it's just about actually talking to people who are from actual places. I don't give a shit about right on Bristol. I don't care. I don't know if that's necessarily where the change is going to come from. Do you know what I mean? I think it's more in places where people are genuinely very pissed off because it's encroaching on their actual lives. They don't have any money, they don't have any comfort zone, and it's encroaching on their actual day-to-day life. And I think that's where the change is going to come from, when that's recognised by alternative groups and by people on the outside of that. I think that's where there's going to be some kind of mobilisation towards change, because when those people feel like there's some kind of appreciation or there's some kind of acknowledgement or some kind of conversation about what pisses them off, that's where something's going to come from, because people are pissed off.
But there is a movement within Bristol that I've noted since I've been down here, where there is a continuing protest against the privatisation of public space. Unfortunately, where I come from, we were unable to do that because of this wealth of money that's piled into Liverpool, which has now been spent to a degree that the city by 2009 will be £160 million in debt. what the end state of that is going to be, I found it quite depressing that that waterfront area that we wanted to keep forever and ever has now been quartered off and partitioned and separated. But I accept the point that day-to-day resistance, even in people's own little way, can have major cumulative and consequential effect. So I'll take your point on that. Thanks for that.
Should we have just two more questions?
I just want to ask you a bit more about Liverpool, when this idea is about the culture of capital. It seems like, from that you're saying, that culture is a kind of driver of capital accumulation. And then you've got, I want to think about that in relation to class divisions as well. Because how does that come, sorry for those people not interested, but how does like the idea that the relocating football clubs come into that? Because it seems like, you know, what's the story with that? So I know people are really attached to the idea that, you know, the club, Everton Football Club shouldn't go out of the area of Everton. So how do you kind of that?
What no one was aware of when Liverpool went into the year of its capital of culture is that what was driving it, unbeknownst to anyone, there's a group of neocons from America, a fella called Richard Florida, who's written this very trendy book called Creative Cities, which on the surface, this, you know, post-industrial cities can become hugely creative and cultural capital, blah, blah, blah. But of course, his underlying theme is that the only way that can be developed is through outside what we call mobile money. Money's poured in. Here today, gone tomorrow. And that's what drives it. Now, I believe in the city of Philadelphia, because they did not accept part of this process of accepting wholesale private money to run and wholesale privatised local services, they were given a choice. It's called no go, no do. You take it or leave it, you don't get anything. And that's what the two Liverpool's eternal shame. The fella who's dry, or Richard Florida, who's written this very trendy book, but you know, is ultimately part of that neocon cultural consensus, will be one of the major speakers in July 2009. Now, the city council, and I don't absolve the Labour group on this because they were part of the original group, the city council and the Merseyside Development Corporation are up to the neck in it. And there's no way they can get out of it because they've accepted all this outside money, private money. They've got to go along with what that private money says. And of course, what that private money says is that there will be wholesale exclusions within Liverpool's capital of culture, because the mobile money from outside brings with it allegedly mobile creative talent. So all the kids on all ends of Liverpool, on the outskirts, who put together projects to be told, no, 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 there's no money available. Absolutely appalling. But the city at the moment is £65 million worth in debt. They've been given over £300 million to run the... So they spent the £300 million and there's still £65 million in debt. It's absolutely appalling. And the whole city now has altered because it's become one huge, rich landscape. Everything's been flattened. You can't... One time you could navigate, like Bristol, you could navigate your way around Liverpool through all the little side streets. All that's gone. So from one end of the river to the other, it's being built in this huge architectural shape of nothingness. And of course, it's very good as well for surveillance. Because you're all in the one space, going towards the river and coming back. Everything, all the little entry back alleys and all that, flattened. Absolutely appalling. And totally depresses me, because it's been allowed to happen.
It seems to me, in your desire to abolish the nation state, if you succeed, you will then be left with a structureless society. And as we well know from our own personal experience and the study of history, if there isn't some framework of order, then our own evil desires express themselves, and in the unstructured society, those who are prepared to obey their base commands with greater ruthlessness will come to the top, and they will substitute something a good deal nastier than the nation state. If we want liberty and a minimum of government, we have to recognize that within human beings there is a potential for good and a potential for evil. And also, we are gregarious animals. We need to be in groups. And we need those groups so that the people can bring malefactors to justice.
We're good at that. We've got the highest prison population in Europe.
No, we are not good at it. We are not good at it because we do not recognize the necessity to become engaged with the forces and the instruments of power as they currently exist. If you do that, you will not make much progress, but the progress you make will last. If your desire is for some august day of outrage in which the present is swept away, and you will live to regret it.
What I'd say, you see, I don't think we've ever had the chance. I'm well aware of the enclosure of the human body, the enclosure of the human mind. I don't think we've ever had the chance to explore what the potential of human liberty is, because we are continually being enclosed and regulated and disciplined.
Yeah.
I do not accept the human nature has a dark side to it. I don't even think we know what human nature is, because we've never had a chance to find out, because we're always segregated and closed, put into classes, put into this, put into the other. I would love to get to a point where we would know what are, if there are any limits to human nature and humankind. But I don't think we've ever been allowed to explore that, because we're always being enclosed.
You don't push against it sensibly.
Yeah, well done.
And it's called The Mother Maria, and it's just really recently been like premiered and come out, and I think you can get it on the internet, and it's really, really fascinating. It's all like to do with ways that you could open borders and the state could like still survive but change, and it's really, really brilliant. I think it's called The Mother Maria, and it's by Worldwide, an organization called Worldwide. They do really incredible films.
Okay, that's it.
Right, yeah, let's... I mean, I'm sure we've got plenty more time to discuss, but we'd like to have a break now and a cup of tea and relax for a while. And I would just first of all say thanks for Steve for doing the talk. So,
yeah.